Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Braeburn Investor Results presentation. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions when prompted. If you should need assistance during the call, please signal an operator by keying in star and then zero. Please note that this event is being recorded. I will now hand you over to Mr. Peter Hayward-Butt. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks very much, Judith. Good morning and welcome to all our investors and stakeholders. Thank you very much for taking the time this morning to listen in to the results. Today marks hopefully one of the final steps in the value unlock journey that we've been on for the last 5 years. As Ethos, as the manager of Braeburn, we undertook at the time to look to unlock the value in the various assets of the business and distribute the remaining assets to shareholders. One of the key parts of that is obviously repaying the debt that sits within Braeburn. We've done a pretty decent job of that. I think we've gone from 7 billion to 1.7 billion. And today marks the sort of final journey, hopefully, of being able to do that and therefore unlock value and distribute the assets to shareholders. So today we'll go through in a bit more detail the holistic solution, which will see Braeburn repay its convertible bonds, which are pound-based convertible bonds, and raised capital to repay some debt in Virgin Active to facilitate growth and a listing of that business in time. This will, as I've mentioned, enable us to unbundle the remaining assets that will be then listed to our shareholders and get rid of the discount that exists in the current share price. So today we'll go through in a bit more detail the transaction. I'll unpack the transaction in detail and the impact that has on Braeburn. And then we've also got Dean and Mark from Virgin Active and Curvis from Premier, who will go through in some detail the underlying portfolio companies. We have the presentation on our website, so please feel free to follow it there or on the screen. Hopefully it works better this time. Onto the executive summary page, which is page 5 of the presentation. As I mentioned, we're in the final stages of our value unlock strategy. Very pleasingly, we've seen very strong underlying performance across all three assets in the portfolio. Year-on-year EBITDA growth in Virgin Active was 37%. Fantastic performance by the management team there. Premier, off a very high base of last year, grew again at 18%. The results came out yesterday and have been very well received by the market. And New Look has continued on its turnaround strategy, and its EBITDA was up more than 100% year-on-year to £37 million. So overall, we're very pleased with the underlying performance of the assets. As we all know, COVID had a massive impact on the Virgin Active business, but that business is more than fully recovered. It has a new strategy under Dean and the team and is extremely well positioned for growth going forward. As I mentioned, since March 2020, the Braeburn debt has reduced from around about 7 billion down to current net debt of 1.7 billion as at March 2026, as we've sold some underlying assets and monetize some of our Premier stake. And the final leg of this value unlock strategy I referred to earlier requires three things to happen. Firstly, it's the optimizing and positioning of Virgin Active for a possible listing. And that talks to, growth in that business so that you can list it on the front foot. It talks to the capital structure being correct so that you can list it. And it talks to optimizing the valuation that we can get for that business. The next is obviously the sale of New Look. That business has turned around and has done a fantastic job, and the process will look to be done relatively soon on that business to hopefully sell that stake. And then obviously all that requires is a repayment of any Braeburn residual debt that would enable us then to facilitate an unbundling of the listed shares to our shareholders and extinguish the discount. To optimize the listing for Virgin Active, as we said, over many years, it does require the business to have a capital structure that is befitting of a listed entity. Based on the feedback we've had from advisors and our own views, we believe that repaying the group debt, the Virgin Active group debt, down to 2x net debt to EBITDA would put it in line with its peer group and facilitate a capital structure that can see that business listed, but will also provide the ability for that business to continue to grow. Dean and Mark will touch a bit on that later. And again, we still think that the target for a listing of Virgin Active is probably the second half of next year or the first half of 2028. And certainly today's transaction provides us with the requisite timing flexibility on that. The proceeds from the sale of Premier shares during 2026 totals about 1.8 billion. That includes a 1 billion rand placing that we did at 1 rand 76 at the back end of last year, and a cap and collar structure which we put in place also at the back end of last year for around about 800 million. So that 1.8 billion has already been monetized from a Brait perspective. To fund the Brait recapitalization, that's the £175 million capital raise that Virgin Active is undertaking, and to fully repay the convertible bonds and the accrued interest of £138 million, will require us to utilize that 1.8 billion rand of Premier proceeds to increase the Brait RCF, which we've agreed terms of with the banks, and draw down about 1.3 billion on that, and then undertake a 2.5 billion rand Brait rights issue, and I'll talk to the terms of that later. Post these various parts of the transaction, Brait will have repaid all its offshore debt, increased its local RCF, and have three very well-capitalized businesses which are performing strongly and we believe are well-positioned to be exited on the front foot. Just a very quick summary, because we'll go into much more detail on the assets. But again, as I mentioned, a very strong performance from all three underlying businesses. Virgin Active had a 37% increase in EBITDA to £110 million, and has continued its growth trajectory since then, at the beginning of this year. A very high return on capital from new gyms. Dean is going to touch on some of that in the presentation. And we have a very, very well-developed pipeline of growth opportunities in the business. However, as we've mentioned, to optimally position that business for a potential exit, we do need to pay down the debt, which is currently at around about 3.4 times net debt to EBITDA, down to 2 times, which would require the business to raise $175 million from its shareholders, of which Brait is a 67% shareholder. We do believe that the growth from the new gyms and the refurbishment program, which is well underway, will well position that business for an exit over the next 2 years. Premier, another stellar performance from Kurvis and his team, very strong operational performance across all of the underlying entities. EBITDA growth of 18% off a very high base of last year was a fantastic result. And I know that Kurvis will touch on that going forward, but the results, you know, to the start of the year has also looked pretty good. From a Millbake perspective, that was the core driver, up 18%, and the ramp up in the Aeroton facility will support strong growth into the full year 2027. The Rhodes Food Group transaction was closed at the end of March, and the integration of that business is well underway. And as I mentioned, Kurvis will touch on that. New Look, very pleasing to say that the trading over the Christmas quarter was in line with expectations. I think that's conservative. I think it was pretty strong. And resulted in the business achieving £37 million of clean EBITDA for this year, up from around about 14 last year. The right sizing of the business and lots of costs that came out of the business and a much more digitally focused model has really led to strong profit growth and really does position that business well. Importantly, the successful launch of Club New Look in-app loyalty program, which has now scaled to nearly 1 million customers, up from about 175,000 just over a year ago, I think has led to a very significant increase overall in that business. From a Brait perspective, the NAV per share is up 7%, up by about 830 million rand over the year. But actually, on a like-for-like basis, and by that I mean if you just take out the equity accounting treatment for the convertible bonds and the exchangeable bonds, it is actually up 11% year on year, which is a decent performance, despite the fact that from a VA perspective, the valuation is actually down 8%. And that is just about wholly down to the fact that the ZAR versus GBP was up by more than 5%. So a strengthening of the RAND versus the pound, obviously, from a RAND perspective, resulted in a decrease in the value of the business. But overall, that business has made very significant progress over the course of the year. I'll let Sabelo just talk quickly to the Brait NAV and the liquidity.
Thanks, Peter, and good morning all. To note at the outset that the peer groups for Virgin Active and New Look remain unchanged, and as Pete said, Brait's audited NAV per share of 3.27 represents a 7% increase compared to March 2025. Total assets of 17.4 billion at reporting date is weighted 54% Virgin Active, 36% Premier, 4% New Look, and 6% in cash and receivable. Total liabilities of 4.6 billion comprise 2.7 billion on the convertible bonds, 1.8 billion on the BIH exchangeable bonds, and 180 million rand in accounts payable. The resultant NAV of 12.6 billion equates to 3.27 rand per share. Slide 9 sets out movements in balance sheet positions for the half for the year. Virgin Active's pound carrying value decreased by 3%. The company is valued on a maintainable EBITDA of 122 million pounds, which was LTM based. The valuation multiple was 9x in line with the peers. Net third party debt of 421 million pounds includes 0.3 million pounds of normalization adjustments for deferred costs. Premier's carrying value increased by 900 million. It is valued at its closing JSE price of 174.25 rand per share for its 19% stake, representing 31.3 million shares. A further 4.7 Premier shares is held within the cap and collar structure that Pete referenced earlier, and which is valued at 0.8 billion. The resultant shareholding in Premier has declined due to the shares held in the cap and collar, placement of 5.6 million ordinary shares earlier this year, raising proceeds of 1 billion rand. And pursuant to Premier's acquisition of RFG, Premier's increased its share, issued share capital. New Look's carrying value reflects LTM EBITDA of 37 million pounds. The unchanged spot multiple of 6.5x represents a 35% discount to the peers, and no normalization adjustments were considered in net third-party debt. Rates equity participation in New Look has reduced to 8.1% following its 2025 capital raise. The increase in cash and receivables of 500 million was largely due to the billion rand raised on Premier shares, offset by the April 2025 repurchase of convertible bonds at a discount to their par value. Turning to page 10, the liability movements were mainly driven by the exchangeable and convertible bonds reflecting their IAS 32 components. Slide 11 analyzes Brait's liquidity and debt and set out on a consolidated basis. In addition to the 1 billion rand raised from Premier, Brait also paid, redeemed 10 million pounds of convertible bonds in April 2025. And as of March 2026, the BML RCF was undrawn, resulting in available liquidity at reporting date amounting to 1.6 billion rand. Thank you, Pete, and back to you.
Thanks, Sabella. So let me now spend a bit of time just talking through at a relatively high level some of the transaction steps. I'm very happy to answer questions at the end of the presentation as well. So first dealing with Virgin Active, as I mentioned, the current gross debt, the gross debt within Virgin Active is currently 460 million pounds. That will post this transaction be reduced by 140 million pounds to 320, which will result in a net debt to EBITDA using 2025 EBITDA of 122 million of 2x. So moving from 3.4x down to 2.0x, and that is reflective of a capital structure which we believe would enable the business to be listed off the back of. This will also provide growth opportunities. There's a 100 million pound accordion facility which can be tapped for growth opportunities if needed going forward. So both the fact that you've reduced the debt and have a facility to facilitate growth provides the business with ample opportunity to continue to grow the business. From a CapEx allocation, and Dean will talk to this, there's some exciting opportunities, predominantly in the Italian and European jurisdictions in terms of new sites and refurbishments in the UK and SA that are either underway or are planned for the course of the next 18 months. All of these are high return on net invested capital projects, where we can leverage our existing footprint. And again, Dean will touch on some of those, both backward-looking to see what returns we have made out of existing refurbishments and new clubs, but also a view as to where we can take the business going forward. Virgin Active has convertible preference shares of 80 million pounds. Those can be converted at the election of the holder of those into shares at Brait NAV or redeemed. Very pleasingly, just about all of that, I mean, 70-odd million of the 80 will be converted into Virgin Active shares using the Brait NAV, and this will result in a reduction in our stake, Brait stake in Virgin Active, from about 67.7 to 61.8. So the conversion of those 70-odd million of the 80 million convertible prefs will be done at our valuation, which again is a pleasing outcome from when we started. So that will reduce debt in the business by a further 80 million pounds. In terms of the VA capital raise, as I mentioned, they're looking to raise 175 million in the company, largely to pay down the debt and also to leave 24 million for growth opportunities. And of that 175, the Brait contribution will be 108 million pounds, which is about 2.4 million billion rand. Just moving on to the Brait side of the equation, as I mentioned, we have already monetized 1.8 billion rand of Premier shares, both in terms of the market placing and the structured sale. The cap and collar, for those of you who don't remember, is 800 million. It has a floor of 166 as a Premier share price and a cap of 186. So, you know, we continue, even at the current share price, to benefit from increase in the Premier share price on that cap and collar structure. And the Brait capital raise is 2.5 billion rand, is the rights issue, which will be priced at a 25% discount to the theoretical ex rights price. And we'll touch on some of the stats over the page. We will redeem in full the convertible bonds that are held in the UK. That's 138 million, which is 134 plus 4 million of accrued interest and PIK. That's 3.1 billion, which will be used to repay the convertible bonds in full. And to do that, we will draw down on the RCF facility to the extent of 1.3 billion out of a 2.5 billion rand facility. At the end of the day, the only debt that will remain in Brait post the transaction is the 1.3 billion. The New Look proceeds, if we assume that we can monetize our New Look stake for the current NAV of 723, that would leave the business with about 600 million rands worth of debt post the sale of our stake in New Look, which is a very manageable level having come down from 7 billion. In terms of just a quick overview of the two, talking again quickly at the Brait level, as I mentioned, it's fully underwritten by Titan to the extent of 2.5 billion rand. It will be priced at a 25% discount to TERP, which means that the TERP is around about 2 rand odd a share, which means that the rights issue will be priced at 1 rand 51. And the strike prices for the exchangeable bond and the convertible bonds will reduce from their current levels to 1 rand 99 in the case of the exchangeable bonds and 7 rand 17 in the case of the convertible bonds, which, as I mentioned, will be redeemed in full. The RCF will be increased from 0.6 billion, which is the current facility size, to 2.5 on very significantly better terms, both in terms of the covenants but also the interest rate that we are charged. Only 1.3 billion of the 2.5 will be drawn on day one. The 138 million pound convertible bond will be fully repaid, and 108 million pounds will be used to fund our share of the VA recapitalization. So if you look on the right-hand side, we start with the convertible bonds at 3.1 billion and cash today of 1.8. Post the rights issue, and by that I mean, you know, we've raised 2.5 in the rights issue. We draw down 0.6, as you can see on the RCF, to repay the convertible bonds of 3.1 billion. And then post the VA recapitalization, 108 million pound injection there, that would see us with the only debt sitting in Brait of 1.3 billion rand. And as I mentioned, hopefully post the New Look sale, that number will be close to 600 million. From a Virgin Active perspective, Virgin Active looks to raise 175 million pounds, which will be funded by its existing shareholders. Brait's share of that is the 108 million pounds I referred to. The existing convertible pref will be converted to equity, predominantly at our valuation, pre the capital raise. The existing debt facilities will be refinanced into one global facility, again, on significantly better terms, and credit to Mark and the team for working on that structure. The group net debt overall will reduce from 413 million pounds, which is 3.4 times net debt to EBITDA today, down to 250 odd million, which is about 2 times net debt to EBITDA, which will result from a senior debt perspective in an interest cost reduction of 14 million pounds. The removal of the convertible preference shares will result in an additional 8 million pound reduction in the interest cost for the business. So 22 million pounds overall will be reduced in the business from an interest cost perspective. Just touching quickly on the sources and uses, I've been through it relatively quickly, but the Premier proceeds, which we've already raised of 1.8 billion, the RCF will be drawn to the extent of 1.3 billion, a rights issue of 2.5 means in total we will raise 5.5 billion, and the uses of that is the convertible bond repayment in full, which is the 3.1 billion, the VA recapitalisation, that's our 108 million pound contribution of 2.4, also equals 5.5. From a Virgin Active perspective, we will raise, effectively convert into shares, 69.7 million pounds in terms of the convertible preference shares. Shareholder equity of 175 million is 245 odd million pounds. And the uses of that would be the redemption of the convertible preference shares, a debt reduction of 140 million, leaving 24 million of growth capital in the business. Just to give people an idea of what does that mean post the rights issue and all these series of transactions for the NAV per share in Brait, on the left-hand side, you have the audited current number, which is the 3.27 that we referred to earlier. And on the right-hand side, you can see the various steps that get you to a revised NAV per share of 2.67. That's including, obviously, the increased number of shares, the redemption of the convertible bonds, and obviously the increased value that is attributed to Virgin Active once you repay the debt in that business. The impact, just to give you a high level of some of the terms of the rights issue will be priced at 1.51, which is a 25% discount to the theoretical ex-rights price of 2.02. The net asset value per share post the transaction will be 2.67. And the rights issue price will effectively, therefore, be priced at about a 43% discount to the net asset value per share, which implies, if you assume that both Premier and New Look are valued at their NAV, around about a 55% discount to the current value that we hold Virgin Active at, which implies just over a 5.5 times EBITDA multiple for that business. In terms of the exchangeable bond strike price, it will reduce from 2.21 to 1.99. That will finally be confirmed when the VWAP is set, but that's based on the numbers we have today. The convertible bond strike price reduces from just under eight rand a share to 7.17. It's still well out the money and will be redeemed out the money. And from a debt perspective, the debt overall will reduce from 3.1 billion today. The only debt outstanding post the transaction will be the 1.3 billion revolving credit facility, which has a debt maturity of June 2029. The overall interest costs within Brait will reduce from 372 million a year down to 262. And as you can see, based on our view of what the dividend is likely to be, you know, for the next year in Premier, you know, about 50% of that interest cost is covered by what we will receive from the Premier dividend. Just in terms of how we, you know, one of the key value unlocks is obviously listing Virgin Active, the business, and credit to Mark and Dean, not just running the business, but looking at how we can monetize this business as well, is well positioned for that. Let me just run through it quickly. You know, from a core business perspective, stabilizing the business post-COVID was an absolute requirement. Achieving 122 million of sustainable EBITDA, which we have now done, and resetting the group strategy around the holistic, you know, approach to wellness. I think we can tick those boxes. We're seeing the benefits of that come through, and we'll see it in the numbers. In terms of new growth initiatives, Mark and Dean and the team have reinvested in the core businesses and increased capex on key sites. A lot of them have been underinvested throughout COVID. You know, that is ongoing, but we're seeing the benefits of that already, and Dean will touch on that. An increased rollout of the new wellness clubs in core locations. The benefits of that are very visible in those gyms that we have opened on that basis. And again, Dean will touch on that. A selective investment into new sites in Europe. We started that. There's two sites that are already operational there, and I think we're making good progress on that. Capital investment to grow Kauai was one of the key ones, both South Africa and internationally. I think we can tick that. That business has been a phenomenal success and continues to grow. And then finding new vectors for growth. We are looking at a number of those. Dean and Mark and the team continue to look at those. They're at an early stage. And obviously, you know, part of that could obviously be M&A. And then actualization of profits and cash flows. That's the important point here. You know, obviously all the capex that we are putting into and have put into these sites will take time to show into the P&L. And we believe that by, you know, late stage 27 and early stage 28, when we're talking about listing the business, that will be evident in the growth and the profits. From a capital structure perspective, We've deleveraged the business to a maximum of 2.5 times net debt to EBITDA. It'll actually be 2 times. We've massively simplified the existing capital structure, and we redeemed the Virgin Active convertible preference shares. We effectively converted those to equity. From a regulatory and corporate governance perspective, again, good progress has been made around ESG and reporting and board governance structures, and the listing documentation and regulatory process will kick off in good time. So overall, I think we've made very, very good progress. There are still some steps to take to get there, but I think overall we're very pleased with the progress that Dean and the team have made. Just quickly touching on the Virgin Active and the impact of the capital raise at VA. I think I've touched on before the convertible preference shares. They were due to mature in November 26th, and all of the existing holders, with the exception of some members of the DK consortium, will convert into Virgin Active equity using the Brace valuation. The DK consortium's convertible pref will be redeemed for cash to enable them to follow their rights in the £175 million rights issue at Virgin Active. So post this, our Brace shareholding will decrease from 67.7 to 61.8. As you can see in the numbers below, we only owned 11.5% of the convertible pref. So overall, our equity stake will be diluted slightly, but at our valuation today, which results overall at the end of the transaction with us having a shareholding of 61.8 worth around about £508 million. And as you can see at the bottom left, the shareholder loans and CPSs that were there as debt will be extinguished, and the only debt that will be left in the business post this transaction is around about 2 times net debt to EBITDA, a global facility of £321 million with cash of £72 million overall. As I mentioned before, this will result in an £8 million saving in terms of the convertible prefs and a £14 million saving in terms of the senior debt. So overall, a £22 million saving from a Virgin Active perspective. Again, a slide some of you may have seen before. Just touching quickly on this slide, what we try to show here is, you know, at the current market valuation, and I've used R2.29 as the Brace share price, you know, what the market is currently implying is a valuation for Virgin Active is $5.6 billion compared to the $9.4 billion where we value it today. If you ascribe most of that discount, or well, all of that discount to Virgin and not the other two assets. And what we've just done on the page below is to show if you believe in 2 years' time when we're looking to list the Virgin Active business, that the EBITDA will grow from 122 to, pick a number, 160 in 2 years' time is about 14% growth a year. We think that's very, very achievable. If the numbers below that spit out what the NAV per share at the time of the unbundling will be for Brace shareholders. So let's take at 9 times. If we do achieve £160 million of EBITDA, and in 2020, you know, the look-through price of Premier increases by the 59 cents that we see at the top there in terms of NAV, overall, the Brace NAV will grow from the current share price of R2.29 to R5.21. Obviously, you could put your own assumptions in there for whatever you think are the right numbers. Moving quickly onto the timetable for the capital raise. Today, the notice of an EGM will go out to approve the share issuance for the rights issue. The EGM will happen on the 16th of July. On the 16th of July, we will launch the rights offer and publish the rights offer circular. With a record date of the 24th of July. The rights offer period will be open from the 27th of July to the 7th of August, with the rights offer being closed and settled on the 13th of August. The redemption notice for the convertible bonds will then be issued on the 13th of August, with settlement of those convertible bonds sometime toward the middle of September. So before we get onto the assets, which I think is probably more interesting, just to give a quick overview of the transaction rationale. So from a Virgin Active perspective, you know, what does this transaction do? It repays pretty expensive group debt, provides a much cheaper, much more flexible fit-for-purpose global funding facility. It provides Virgin Active with, you know, listing-ready capital structure and £22 million of interest cost savings. It reduces the IPO pricing risk by lowering any requirement for primary capital to be raised. Obviously, if we needed to go and raise this amount of money to pay down debt, you're beholden then to whoever comes in to price that capital. This removes that. We provide capital and funding capacity for the value-adding and growth initiatives that Dean and Mark will talk to. and provides additional timing and flexibility for the IPO itself. It's a massively simplified capital structure, and a conversion of the convertible pref at our valuation minimizes any dilution and further reduces the debt. So lots of positives in the business, which Mark and Dean can touch on. From the Brait convertible bond redemption, the maturity date has been extended effectively through the RCF to June 2029. The convertible bonds were due to mature pretty much this time next year, December 2027. So that provides additional flexibility. The competitive funding costs of 9.5%, just over 9% in rand versus 8% in pounds, removes the contingent exchange rate risk, which has been one of the biggest risks that the business has faced, having convertible bond, pound debt, and mostly ZAR assets. And again, I think the RCF terms give you much more fit for purpose, flexible terms to enable us to repay those when we get proceeds, hopefully from the New Look sales process. From a Brait capital raise perspective, it provides all shareholders to participate at around about a 44% discount to NAV per share. It's a holistic solution. We've used Premier proceeds, we've used debt, and part of that is obviously raising equity, but it gives all shareholders the chance to participate in that and therefore benefit from when we get rid of the discount when we unbundle the assets. So it's a comprehensive solution, which we think shareholders should like, hopefully. With that, I will pass it over to Dean to talk more detail about Virgin Active.
Thank you, Peter, and good morning to everybody. Just maybe to start, just to have a look at Virgin Active, to have a look at the industry and just summarize where we sit relative to industry. Today, we're at Virgin Active is truly a global wellness brand. We operate across 9 countries today. We've got 223 premium, what we call social wellness clubs. We've also got 260 health food restaurants. And more important than this, just the geographic spread, it's a globally recognized brand in the wellness space. That evolution from a gym business to a wellness business in the markets that we operate in today is widely accepted, and there's great awareness around the Virgin Active brand. Also, just when we speak global, important to note that today, 65% of Virgin Active's revenue comes from outside of South Africa, once again reinforcing that global wellness positioning and no longer just a South African company. In terms of the health and wellness trends, the category that Virgin Active plays in, this wellness category, we've seen very real, substantial, and accelerated growth taking place in the category that we operate in. The Global Wellness Institute forecasts that wellness spending will reach about $9.8 trillion by 2029. That's up from the current $6.8 trillion. So substantial growth that we do see across the global wellness industry. What are the reasons? What's fueling that growth in the sector and the category that we operate in? There has been a significant change. We've spoken about it before in consumer mindsets post the pandemic, post COVID. People are looking to preventative measures. How do they prevent rather than cure and treat wellness? So we've seen a significant demand for preventative solutions. Things like fitness, nutrition are becoming increasingly important in consumers' minds. And then probably the biggest driver of this change or this growth in the wellness category is this generational reallocation of spend. And that reallocation of spend is taking place in both the youth, when I say youth, millennials, Gen Zs, 21 to 34-year-olds, they are spending a much greater share of their wallet on wellness rather than some of the traditional social categories that we saw in the past, like bars and like nightlife. Today, alcohol spending as a share of household budgets is at nearly 40-year lows, and that's largely driven by these younger generations seeking out more healthy behaviors, and we refer to this change in that younger segment as a move from bar stools to barbells. It's not only the youth that are fueling that growth. The older generation today is also more focused on longevity, health span, not just about living longer, but by living better, and how to personalize that wellness journey. So between the youth reallocating their spend and the middle and older generations also reallocating their spend, we've seen this fueling growth and larger portions of discretionary income being allocated to the wellness sector. This today we see wellness really treated largely as non-discretionary, so increasingly becoming more recession resilient as more higher proportions of disposable income are focused on the wellness sector. From a Virgin Active point of view, this move away from just a gym business to a wellness business, the premiumization of our estate to what we call a social wellness club, has squared us, Virgin Active, at the intersection of the fastest growing trends within the wellness space around physical activity, recovery, nutrition, social connection, preventative health, and experiential wellness, all of the sectors now, or the categories that Virgin Active plays in. The business has an extremely strong moat. As I mentioned, 233 premium clubs, 260 health food restaurants spread across the globe. This quality portfolio of clubs and restaurants in major cities around the world, and in within those cities we have some of the most iconic flagship locations, makes it very difficult for a new entrant to replicate that model on a global scale there. On top of that, today we have a very experienced management team. The management team is a blend, a good blend between industry experience. We have some of the best industry knowledge that sits in the business. But in addition to that, we've strengthened the management team with some people from outside the industry, from hospitality experience, that have strengthened our management team and enabled the business to grow. So a lot of credit to the enhanced and improved management team that we have in place. Next slide, Pete. From a growth point of view, there are multiple levers for us to grow, and we've used those levers quite successfully in the existing business. And the major levers we have, Pete, if you can go, so that's right, are around volume, retention, how do we keep our members for longer, and an increase in our yields, and also how do we attract a greater share of wallet from our existing membership base? How do we increase our basket size? And we've used multiple strategic initiatives to help us achieve that. Some of those initiatives include investing in the existing estate, expanding our product offering. We've rolled out things like reformer Pilates, recovery, spa spaces, all areas that help us drive up yields, but also improve retention, engagement with our business. We've embraced the hospitality experience. Traditional gyms have not been focused on hospitality. It's a big part of what we do today. Service hospitality. How do we engage? How do we make our members feel? A big initiative around data, AI, digital transformation, which includes our new reward system, our app, which is used by the majority of our members today, which has really pushed up levels of engagement, frequency, how often our members change in our club. So all of this in terms of the existing business has resulted in the growth that we've seen over the last 2 years. We're at the stage now where we have the ability to replicate that growth and replicate it at scale, and that's what Pete was referring to. We have the opportunity to now to use these levers, to use these growth initiatives, both in existing territories to open new clubs in existing territories, but also to look at new territories across continental Europe today and replicate that successful model that we've proven with the existing state with space growth in new territories. Next slide. One of the questions I often get asked is, what is the impact of AI? Is it possible that AI is going to replace the Virgin Active clubs? What we see is that the space we play in addition to wellness, which is this massive change and social trend, the space we play experience economy, and that experience economy, these in real life experiences, also continue to grow, and they continue to grow faster as the digital economy grows. People are looking for an escape from the digital world. They're looking for a sense of community, a place to belong. And these human connections, these in real life experiences, only become more valuable and more scarce as the AI economy grows. So we don't see at all AI replacing the experience economy. They're certainly not replacing the social wellness club concept. It's a strong moat that we have, and AI just is an enhancer of that in real life experience that you can have at Virgin Active Social Wellness Clubs. We've spoken a lot about the social wellness club, the premiumization of our estate, and it's probably worthwhile just having a look to see what are the proof points? What is the result of that strategy? Do we have enough proof points to demonstrate that the impact of this change to a social wellness club? The first genuine social new club, not refurb of an existing club, was a club we opened in Bondi, Westfield, which is a highly competitive market. We opened a 2,400 square meter club in the Westfield Mall in Bondi. We spent about £6.5 million on that club. And that has performed well ahead of our expectations. Generally, we see in the past, in the old gym model, that a club took between 9 and 12 months to get to break even, to ramp up. So there were startup losses. This club, the Bondi Westfield Club, after 3 months was at break even and is now a highly profitable club. We would estimate that club, based on its current run rate, to have a payback of about 3.3 years. So an exceptional performance from that club, 2,400 members, getting close to capacity, which will give us, once we're at capacity, the ability to yield that club up even further. So a really good proof point in terms of the ability to open a new club in an existing territory with the broad wellness offering. Coming to South Africa, we took an existing club, which is the Point Club in Greenpoint in Cape Town, and we did a major, major refurb. It is almost like a new club. That's a large footprint club. We invested around £5.7 million in that club. And where we sit today is that we largely back very close to the pre-refurb membership numbers. As of today, we're slightly over 9,000 members at that club, and that is on the back of a significant price increase across that club. When we first announced that price increase prior to opening the club, there was rightly a lot of concern around the level of that price increase, a lot of questions asked around the ability for a club in South Africa to support that level of pricing. Post-opening, post-members experiencing and seeing that enhanced wellness offering, the sentiment has totally, totally changed. We, as I said, sales have been strong in that club, retention is strong in that club, also operating ahead of expectations with us forecasting about a 2.7-year payback period on that South African club. Next slide. A club in the UK, so we've seen a proof point in Australia, we've seen this proof point in South Africa, a club in the UK, Chiswick Riverside, club that we've also embarked on a significant refurb, and similar results that we've seen is once we do this refurb, once we convert the gym into a social wellness club, and those metrics around retention, engagement, ability to yield the club up, and once again, a three-year payback period. So payback periods really accelerated with the social wellness club concept. Looking at some other clubs in South Africa that didn't have as comprehensive a refurb, but we did do work on them, new equipment, certain of the social spaces update, and we compared those clubs, call it those clubs where we've invested CapEx against a similar cohort of clubs in the same tier where we didn't reinvest. And across all the tiers that we operate in, our premium classic clubs, our flagship clubs, our fitness clubs, and the mid-tier clubs, in all of those clubs where we invested CapEx, they've outperformed the same clubs in the same tiers. So we do see across every single investment case where we invest in our clubs, we get superior returns and superior performance compared to where we haven't invested. So part of the strategy, as Pete said, in terms of the capital raise, is to ensure we can reinvest into our existing estate, get the type of returns that we've demonstrated with the social wellness concept in our existing state, but also to look to replicate the models like Bondi Westfield to open new clubs in new territory, in existing territories. And we also believe there's an opportunity across continental Europe to go and replicate the model. We have two clubs currently that are in construction, one in Vienna, one in Lugano in Switzerland, that will open over the next 9 to 12 months, where we expect to replicate that social wellness club concept in Europe. So just to summarize, in terms of what we've done as Virgin Active in implementing the social wellness club strategy, we believe we position Virgin Active now as less of a commodity, no longer competing on price alone. It's become a destination. It's become a lifestyle. When we're able to do that, we make price less relevant by really changing the category that we compete in. We're capturing some of the fastest growing trends that we see in wellness. We're not just a fitness operator. And we start to monetize our most valuable asset, which is these large footprint clubs that we have, the breadth of our operation. And this is something that our competitors, whether they're the low-cost operators, the boutique operators, can't replicate, the breadth of our offering. And then lastly, the social wellness club builds this moat around us as AR commoditizes digital wellness content. AR cannot replicate our social wellness clubs. It cannot replicate our physical spaces, the community, and the sense of belonging that a social wellness club delivers. So I think the business is well positioned now. We're wrapped well out of the recovery phase, looking forward to growth. But now I'll let Mark take you through some of the numbers.
Thanks, Dean, and good morning to all participants on the call. At the previous investor update, we updated you on numbers to the 30th of September 25, and today I'm going to update you on trading for both the December 25 end and the first quarter to March 2026. So starting on our revenue progression, December 25, we saw 636 million pounds of revenue. That was a 60 million pound or 10% increase on the prior year. And looking through to the annualized Q1 number, that would be an annualized run rate of 693 million of revenue for the first quarter, which is a 57 million or 9% increase over the financial year 25. So very similar growth rates in revenue flowing through. Going down to EBITDA, 2025 financial year EBITDA was 110 million pounds, which was a 30 million pound or 38% increase in EBITDA. Looking at the first quarter 26 run rate, that's 125 million pound run rate or a 50 million pounds, up 14% on the FY25 year. And then flowing down to our cash flow before financing, 2025 saw a 22 million pound increase in cash flow before financing to 54 million pounds. The equivalent number for the first quarter is 56 million pounds. The reason it doesn't show the same increase as you're seeing in the EBITDA is that we've had a significant number of club reinvestment projects, as Dean's touched on in his section, that have impacted cash flow, but we expect the returns on that to flow through in subsequent periods. Next slide, please, Peter. Right. Just looking at our membership and revenue progression on a segmental basis, starting with our South African business on the top left. South Africa had a 6% increase in revenue comparing Q1 26 to Q1 25. From a membership perspective, we were down 2%, but our yields were up 7%. The strategy in SA has been focused on yield management. There's been a focus on improving the quality of sales. We've reduced the number of sales promotions, which themselves will reduce sales volumes, but they'll improve firstly, the yield. We'll be selling at a higher price and increase retention because of the higher quality of sale. And while members have been down 2% over the period, our usage is up 13%, and that signals much better engagement of our members, which will drive long-term positive trends in terminations. We have seen some weakness in South Africa in the mid to lower segments. As Dean's touched on, we've also seen a difference between where we've invested in clubs and where we haven't invested in clubs, and our strategy is to continue to invest in clubs where they are uninvested. But the premium end of the market, where most of our volume and yield sits, remains resilient. Moving on to Italy on the bottom left, Italy's revenue quarter on quarter is up, or March 26 versus March 25 is up 7% in revenue. That's membership was up 1% and yield up 5%. The focus on in Italy has been on yield management, as those clubs have been reaching capacity. They've enjoyed strong growth over the last few years, and the focus of the business now is to move towards space growth to create more capacity in that business. We've opened three new clubs, two in the fourth quarter of 2025 and one in the first quarter of 26. Those are responsible for the 1% volume growth that we've seen in that Italian business, and those clubs are trading in line with our expectations of positive trends across the Italian business. Moving on to the UK, UK saw revenue grow by 9%. That was driven by a 1% growth in membership and a very strong 13% yield growth. The yield growth in the UK has been coming from the premiumization of the estate. We've invested in a number of the clubs in terms of upgrades, equipment, studios, and some major upgrades like Chiswick Riverside that Dean took you through. Our focus there is to position the UK as the number one premium operator in the market. And you know, the positives coming out of the UK business, despite the 13% yield increase, we've only seen a 1% increase in attrition in that market. That's indicative of the market accepting price increases where we invest in the clubs. And lastly, moving on to APAC, bottom right, that's Australia, Singapore, and Thailand. Revenue was up 9%, membership was down 2%, and yield was up 6%. We sort of have to break that down across the various territories to tell a cleaner story. For Singapore and Thailand, they continue to perform well and being the outstanding performers over the last 12 months. Australia remains a bifurcated market. It's had 10% revenue growth, but you know, that growth has come from our residential clubs and Bondi Westfield. The CBD clubs in the Australian market remain a challenge with work from home trends, and they will be the drivers of the volume reduction across that market. Next, Lisa. Okay, so adding all this up, looking at financial year December 25 and Q1 26, sales for the group to December 25 were up 2%. Those are predominantly driven by the UK, which is up 4%, and Italy 5%. The attrition rates were deteriorated by 4 percentage points. That's been predominantly driven by the yield increases that we put through the business. So you'll see there we've got an average yield increase of 9%. There have been some disruption around refurbishments in the business that will be driving that number. But overall, our membership increased by 1% in the financial year. Added that together with a 9% yield increase, we had an 11% increase in Virgin Active revenue, a 34% increase in Virgin Active EBITDA, and then our Kauai business delivered about 4.6 million EBITDA, but very strong 81% year-on-year increase. So that gets us to 110 million pounds, or our 37% year-on-year increase for December 25. Looking at March, the bottom block, March 25, first quarter, we've seen an 8% reduction in sales, and that is largely around two things. Firstly, we are selling at higher prices, hence the 8% yield, and we have reduced our promotional offers significantly year on year in order to drive higher yields and better long-term retention. Our attrition rate has deteriorated by 2 percentage points in that period. That's still a wash through of some of our yield increases in the 2025 financial year. A 1% is attributable to the way Italy accounts for its corporate contract. So if a large corporate cancels and re-signs, that's both a sale and a termination. But overall, our active membership is down 1% year on year. Yield is up 8%, therefore revenue is up 8%, and EBITDA is up 11%. Kauai's had a good start to year once again, up 31%. Overall, the group EBITDA is up 12%. Next slide, please, Peter. Okay, so there is seasonality in our business, but I think an important part is when we look at the overall quarterly trends of the business. If we start on the left-hand side, going back to Q2 and Q3 2024. That was we were still sort of tail end of the recovery, COVID recovery period for the business. And if we compare that to Q2 and Q3 25, there was a 43% increase in EBITDA. And a lot of that was the operating leverage. We had new members going into existing capacity that drove that strong growth. What we are seeing now is more of a normalization of EBITDA growth as the clubs fill up and as we start to bring new clubs into the pipeline. They will add to the operating cost and potentially be a drag on short-term EBITDA, but those will be the drivers of our long-term growth for the business. So when we look at Q2 24 and Q1 25 and compare that to Q4 25 and Q1 26, we see an overall 14% increase in our EBITDA growth. So the 28.9 million pounds EBITDA in Q1 26 will have some drag from the new club openings in, which will unwind as those clubs grow. Looking at the bridge from where are we today in terms of our trailing 12 months EBITDA and how do we get to the mature EBITDA of 122 million that we use for the purposes of the valuation. Starting with 110 million pounds EBITDA in 2025, our trailing 12 months when we get to March 26 is 114.3 million. In that number, there are some more one-off adjustments that will wash through in the future. Firstly, there are some club closures around the reefers. Main one there being the Point closure for a period of time. That was 0.8 million pounds that unwinds once that club reopens. There's the impact of startup losses in the three new Italian clubs of 1.9 million pounds. Offsetting that is there was EBITDA of about 0.6 million for clubs that we have closed, which will come out of our future EBITDA. But that all collectively comes to 2.1 million pounds. So you put that together with our 114.3 million March last 12 months EBITDA, we get to 116.4 million. We'll call that a sort of a normalized March 26 EBITDA. And then the embedded EBITDA, i.e. what those three Italian clubs will deliver at maturity would be 5.6 million pounds. So that all adds up to 122 million pounds supporting where we are in terms of break valuation. But when you compare that to what our Q1 26 EBITDA run rate of 125, those two numbers largely align. Next slide, Peter. Thank you. So with the post-COVID recovery complete, focus is shifting to growth. And while we continue to leverage any spare capacity in the estate, as clubs fill, we'll need to start to invest in creating new space, which will drive long-term value creation. So it's important for us to start to discuss capital allocation and return on capital. And this business does have a strong track record in terms of delivering returns on both new clubs and major refurbishments. Starting with the topic and looking at our new clubs, and these are all the new clubs that we've opened in the last 12 years, and looking at the return on invested capital, which we measure as mature EBITDA, year three EBITDA, less maintenance capex, so that is the cash that a club will deliver over its initial capex. We've had very strong returns from our clubs in South Africa and Italy. They've mainly been what we call hot shells, where we've had significant landlord contributions that have reduced our capital investment into those clubs. Across the other territories, the Australian residential markets delivered a very respectable 26% return on invested capital. The UK 15, that's one club in the UK, which is a CBD location. Then Singapore, Thailand were 10 and 9%. Now that they are slightly understated because Singapore and Thailand had longer than 3-year ramp-ups to maturity, and those clubs are certainly performing much better today than they were at their 3-year point. And then lastly, the Australia CBD sites, for reasons we've articulated before around work-from-home trends, they haven't delivered meaningful return on invested capital. But overall, when you look at the hot shell model, it's averaged about 55% return on invested capital. The cold shell 11. So yeah, that clearly points for us in terms of focusing on where and opportunities where we can get significant landlord contributions. Then looking across the types of market we invest in, we've had 31% return on residential markets, 28% on mixed use, and an 8% on CBD locations. So that indicates our focus will be on more mixed use and residential markets. And one of the reasons is that they have better capacity utilization. We can drive usage through the upday versus CBD locations, which have peak hour constraints plus the work from home complications. And just looking at payback, and then the payback is measured by the mature EBITDA year three over the initial capex. Strong paybacks, 1.4 years and 2.7 years in South Africa and Italy, respectively. Longer periods in Australia and the UK because they have cold shells. And then Singapore and Thailand, if you use the year three number, we will get a significantly higher payback. But given that the strong performance of those clubs in subsequent years, like we've seen over the last 2 years, those numbers will come down. Finally, in the major refurbs, these are our highest returns across the club, and they come at the lowest risk. So we're investing in known markets where we have an existing member base that we can leverage. And when we do invest in those, unlike new clubs, we're not adding additional operational costs into those businesses. We're utilizing existing rent, staff, et cetera. So they drive very strong returns on capital for us. What we're seeing in the South African market is 124% average return on capital from our major refurbs with a one-year payback. In Italy, very similar number, 125%, a shorter 0.8 years payback. And then even within the UK business, respectable 60% return on investor capital and a 2.2-year payback on that capital. Next slide, please, Peter. Okay. So just bringing that all together, you know, talking about how we look at allocating our capital and what are our plans for the next few years. Hot shells are our default model. You know, leverages landlords low required yields and de-risk their own capital allocation. We still will use cold shells, what we call special situations. Sometimes when you go into a new market, you may have to do your first club as a cold shell to prove the concept, or sometimes there might be absolutely prime location that we must have, but we're going to only do on a cold shell basis. But that'll be the exception rather than the norm. We focus on large club sizes. Some of the CBD locations have been smaller purely because it's hard to find space, but our model is being able to drive both yield and volume and having the optionality to toggle between yield and volume to drive growth. And the other aspect of, I think, the larger clubs is that it significantly differentiates our product versus competitors or boutiques or budget operators. We certainly focus on mixed use of residential markets. Both for the spread of the usage throughout the day, which allows us to penetrate higher volumes, but also within residential locations, we tend to get lower build costs and lower rent because of the lower land costs. We absolutely want to focus on premium positioning in the market. That gives us superior yields, it creates a brand aspiration, a halo effect, and it gives us greater economic resilience through various market turns. We want to direct capital into the right markets. Firstly, if we're going to existing markets, they're known markets. We know the brands established, they come at a lower risk. So when you see our roll-up profile is much more slanted towards where we are at the moment. But at the same time, we need to create new markets to offer runway for growth. So we'll be balancing it between continue to grow in existing markets, but finding new opportunities. But wherever we go, we're looking for depth of demand. We want to find density of affluence with a runway for growth. So we're looking at major global cities which have that density of affluence where we believe we can put our first club in and scale them to at least five clubs beyond that number. And finally, as we mentioned, we'll be very selective on pure CBD locations until the work from home trends reverse if they ever do. So on the right-hand side, we've set out our current new club profile. So we have, at the moment in Italy, we've got a plan to build the Italian estate out to approximately seven clubs. We've got 11 leases signed, another 13 at a heads of term stage. In the UK, we have one club. South Africa, we have four clubs. Two of those are largely secured, one in Singapore. And then we'll continue to look at continental Europe, expanding beyond, leveraging our base in both London and Milan to tap into new markets. We have one lease signed in Vienna, Austria. We've got another number of sites we're looking at across the European markets. And once again, we'll be focusing those on large formats, hot shells, to the extent that we can. Last slide, please. Okay, just getting back to the capital raise, and Peter has touched on this, but I thought it, from our perspective, is worthwhile just emphasizing the importance of this and the various reasons. The first is our balance sheet strengthening. By repaying $140 million of existing debt, we'll be reducing our net debt leverage down to 2x EBITDA. That's important both in terms of how we position for a possible IPO, but also brings down, significantly reduces our margin and therefore our interest cost by about £40 million per annum. That £40 million gives us optionality in terms of investments. And what we're finding as we go into new markets is that, you know, from a lease covenant perspective, a strengthening balance sheet significantly improves our opportunities in terms of A, securing new sites, and B, securing those sites at attractive market rent, including getting the capital contributions we need for those hot shells. The second point is obviously the IPO readiness. That's clearly on the horizon for us. This will give us an appropriate public market capital structure ahead of any IPO. It reduces the requirement for primary proceeds, which eliminates or reduces the pricing risk on an IPO. And it's certainly it's a strong endorsement from existing shareholders, and it sends a positive signal to the markets in terms of, or certainly to public investors, based on that shareholder support. The next pillar for us is growth. It's important that we accelerate our growth to support our equity story. New clubs or even the refurbishment programs have long pipelines. And if we're looking at a late 27, early 28 IPO, we need to get going on a number of new opportunities now, so you know we can build that equity story and demonstrate the successful track record that we've had to date and will continue to deliver. From a valuation perspective, the lower leverage, the higher liquidity, that position us closer to our listed peer benchmarks and certainly creates the pathway towards getting a premium public market valuation. And finally, in terms of strategic optionality for Dean and I, you know, we want to grow this business. We are growing this business, but this gives us, you know, plays both offense and defense. You know, we've got a stronger balance sheet. We'll make the business more resilient in terms of any downturn. But obviously, the stronger balance sheet allows us to chase the or to seek the growth opportunities that will ultimately drive that future valuation of the business. And that concludes my section, Peter. Over to you.
Thanks, Mark and Dean. And look, again, thanks very much to you and the team for what a great job. You know, you've done a fantastic job growing the business in not easy conditions in some of those markets. So well done. We're very appreciative. Talking also about growing in difficult markets, I'm going to hand over to Kovas, who can run through the Premier slides.
Thank you very much, Peter. Just from an overall level, the past year through 31 March 2026, our revenue up 6.6% to 21.2 billion. That was probably lifted by about 0.5% or so as a result of the 21 days of the RFG numbers that we had to consolidate from 11 March through to 31 March. Our EBITDA up 2.8 billion, very small contribution for the consolidation there. That's mostly Premier's own performance before the acquisition. 18.2% increase, EBITDA margin up to 13.1%. It's really a long march that we have been on to try and get our margins to continue to improve. EBIT up 23.2% to 2.4 billion, EBIT margin 11.1 billion, also a nice uptick there. And then our return on invested capital continuing to grow up to the almost 28% now, with the headline earnings per share 12 rand 4 cents, also up almost 28%. The final dividend 1 rand 82, we did the interim special dividend to align the dividend payout time periods between the RFG side and the Premier side in anticipation of the transaction. Hence, we're just paying the final dividend now. And then our leverage ratio on a standalone basis as Premier before the RFG acquisition coming down to 0.5 times. From a overall perspective, I think the RFG Holdings acquisition, or Roche Food Group, has been well discussed. It increased the number of shares in issue from around about 128 million to 166 million, as it was an all-share deal on one Premier share for every seven RFG shares. As I said, the transaction was went unconditional on the 11th of March, even though we only took effective control of the business on the 30th of March. But in terms of accounting rules, we were forced to do the consolidation from the 11th onwards. We consolidated the business, or completed the transaction, at 172.78 rand per share. When we announced the transaction back in the beginning of October, we were trading around 140 rand a share. And so the extent to which the share price has increased as the market has supported the transaction have also then increased the effective transaction value up to 6.5 billion. That has probably added somewhere around about 750 to 900 million rand of extra goodwill onto our balance sheet as a result of that increase in the price between announcement and conclusion of the transaction. Then the RFG business is now called Premier Culinary Division, and we will include it in our groceries division going forward. And we've also decided to remove our Mozambican business out of the groceries division, as it's very closely aligned with Molbike. And so that will be performed part of the Molbike division going forward. And we will see going forward around about two-thirds of the revenue and profit contribution coming from the Molbike division and one-third coming from the groceries division. That will include culinary, our personal care business, and the sugar confectionery business. Just from an overall balance sheet perspective, we obviously consolidated the full balance sheet at the end of March, but we've only had the 21 days worth of trading contribution, and so a lot of the ratios that draws off the balance sheet is a little bit skewed at year end, as we'll see. Just overall, as I said, EPS was exactly the same whether we consolidated RFG or not, and the HEPS was 3 cents higher, so fairly negligible contribution. From a category perspective, our Molbike division, representing 83% of our revenue, is still the big engine that has been driving our performance. We've been on a multi-year nice run-up in revenue. One must remember always that the Molbike division is very heavily impacted at a revenue level by global grain prices. At times we see big inflationary pushes on the grain prices like we did in 2021. And then subsequent years we see a big sort of backward move in grain prices as ample global stocks are available, and that then puts a little bit more subdued revenue growth on the division. And so it really is about looking at the longer term growth rate across that division to smooth for the gyrations in global grain prices. From an EBITDA perspective, continue to drive operational efficiencies, using operational leverage with a fairly high cost based structure. And as we've managed to add volume, sales volume onto that structure, and also consolidate inefficient operations, build larger scale bakeries with the almost 3 billion rand that we've invested over the last 3 years, one continues to see the benefit of that falling through to the EBITDA line. Our Aeroton bakery was commissioned. The first line was up and running and producing commercially in the third week of January. And the second line only started up in March, and so also from Aeroton perspective, a fairly small contribution in this year's numbers, and we should see a proper full-year contribution in the 2027 financial year going forward. The Hermanstad bakery has been closed. It is the one that was feeding Aeroton while we were building it. It was at the end of its commercial life, and we've actually repurposed that site into a new technical training center to develop maintenance skills for our group. Pete, you can move to the next one. From a groceries international perspective, this division has always been held back a little bit by the performance of our Mozambican business, which is Compagnie Industrial de Matola, or SIM. Revenue has been somewhat subdued as that business in particular has struggled with the difficult economic conditions within Mozambique. But we've also seen a nice continued growth in the EBITDA as both our candy and our personal care businesses have gained a lot of momentum. We've invested heavily in these two businesses over the last year in particular. From a personal care perspective, we have installed and commissioned first liners line out of China with automated packing line, and so we always used to import all of those products into South Africa, and we are now making all of that product for our own market here locally in our factory in Durban. We've also put new automation lines onto our existing pads line that we installed 4 years ago. We've brought some more of our Wrigley tampon manufacturing machines that used to be stationed with a third-party provider in Taiwan. We've relocated some of those machines into South Africa, and we now have 8 Wrigleys where we previously had 5 running in that facility. And all of that improvements that we've made there and capital investment have gone in during this past financial year, and we're hoping that we will also see full-year contribution from those increased production capacity going forward. From a sugar confectionery perspective, I think there's been a lot of press that has gone out about us having taken over the 150-plus SKUs on the chocolating side for Woolworths in particular. The massive effort that went in with the team to try and onboard all of those products. Many of those products we've never made before, and so we had to go through both learning how to manufacture that and also get all of that through the Woolworths Gold Seal approval processes, and the teams have done a magnificent job in onboarding all those products. We also installed, at the beginning of last year, we installed the brand new licorice manufacturing line that is also now running very well and producing top quality products for Woolworths, but also under our own brands. Mr. Sweet in particular. So a lot of investment, a lot of activity. We traded well into the Easter period. We pretty much, it was us and Tiger with their Beacon brand that supplied Easter eggs for the Easter period. And good trading by this business. And obviously, we'll see the full year benefit of all of those onboarded products and increased volumes going through our facilities during the next year going forward. Thank you, Pete. Then from a CapEx perspective, our CapEx has stepped up to just over R1 billion, now being 4.8% of revenue. And that's really driven by the finalization of the Aeroton bakery in particular. You'll see that the bulk of the capital expenditure has gone into the Millbake division, with the Groceries International division also then the all the lines in the personal care and the candy side that we've also installed. You'll see that from a borrowings and group debt perspective, we've continued to chip away at our debt. We certainly were, as the Gulf War erupted and a lot of increases in interest rates were being anticipated, have taken a more conservative view and have continued to drain our, especially the debt that we acquired from RFG post year end. Obviously, that looks like it's subsided a bit, and one will have a look and see what we do going forward. But ultimately, from a group perspective, consolidated with RFG, I think we would like to get our debt down to the 0.5 times EBITDA ratio on a long-term basis. Just from a return on invested capital perspective, I've mentioned the 28% on a standalone basis, dropping to 17.6%. That's both as a result of the excessive goodwill, I guess, that we picked up on the RFG transaction as the value of the shares increased between announcement and completion date, but also because we don't have a full year contribution on the income statement, but we've had to take the full balance sheet on. So we expect that number to continue to rise as the RFG's income statement performance gets consolidated into our numbers towards our interim results by 30 September. Our capital structure, I've spoken about the delisting there. But we have done the share repurchases in March. We're using the general authority that's been given to us by our shareholders and our AGM. That means we're not allowed to buy back any shares during a closed period, which obviously started on 1 April and concluded on yesterday morning when we announced our results. And to the extent that we have additional spare cash available over the coming months, we would look to continue with that buyback program. From a dividend perspective, we pay out at a 30% payout ratio on diluted headline earnings per share. When we listed, that number was around 200 million a year in dividend payments, and as our profitability has grown, that's moved towards the 600 million level, and so we feel that we are adequately giving our shareholders the benefit of the increased performance through the fixed payout ratio, and don't foresee lifting that in the near term. Final dividend for the year then, including the special dividend that was paid in January, being R3.41. Thank you, Pete.
Kumis, thanks very much. And again, thanks so much.
That's it from a senior perspective.
Yeah, and as I said, look, thanks so much. And thank you very much from a Brait perspective. You guys have done a fantastic job there. So we massively appreciate it. Just quickly onto New Look. I won't take as long on New Look. It's only 4% of our NAV, but, you know, equally a decent story there. You know, revenue for the year down just about 4%, but actually more like for like, it's about flat with some store closures that happened during the course of the year. So the like-for-like comparison is close to flat. But probably very importantly, on a gross profit perspective, slightly up year-on-year despite the lower sales, with gross profit margins being, you know, up nearly 3%. And I think this was a function of a couple of things. Firstly, you know, better stock management throughout the year, you know, better price management and lesser markdowns throughout the year, resulting overall together with all the cost savings that they've made throughout the year, EBITDA growing from 14 million, up to nearly 36.6 million. So more than 100% growth year on year. So, you know, a good job puts the business in a good place. As we mentioned before, you know, there still remains the option to sell this business. I think the business is on a better footing. It's successfully launched their club New Look and have nearly 1 million active members, which is fantastic. It gives you a much better understanding, you know, of what those members' habits are, you know, better use of data and better stock management comes out of having a million members that you know intimately. So overall, you know, the impact of the right sizing of the business, the migration to more of a digital rather than a retail heavy infrastructure, you know, has served this business well, and we've seen a really good turnaround in the profits. You know, dealing quickly again on these numbers, as we can see, the overall decline in revenue of 3.6 actually was driven by the UK retail segment. So that's the bricks and mortar side of the business. But as I mentioned, there was a number of store closures included in that. So on a like-for-like basis, it actually looked a lot better. The New Look digital part of the business actually grew year on year, despite a pretty tough market in the UK, to be honest. And we continue to see this going forward. So it outperformed a declining market. And overall, with the significant costs that came out of the business and through the efficiency drive, a significant increase in EBITDA to 37 million, a strong de-gearing during the course of the year with third-party net debt only at 0.7 times EBITDA. Just quickly on the valuations, I won't dwell on these. You know, they're not too dissimilar to what we've seen in the past. From a Virgin Active perspective, as I mentioned, the maintainable EBITDA of 122. We've reduced the multiple slightly based on the peer group set coming down slightly to 9 times, back to 9 times. Overall, a slight decline in the pound equity value from 577 to 553. That's largely driven by the fact that the net debt has gone from 379 to 421, as I mentioned before. And if you look at on a rand basis, the carrying value is 9393 compared to 10.2 billion. That's largely reflective of the fact that the rand strengthened by 5% during the course of the year. Onto New Look, again, very similar, you know, methodology we've applied, 6.5 times EBITDA multiple compared to the peer average of just under 10. The EBITDA, maintainable EBITDA of 37, which we've applied, plus the lower net debt, means that overall the carrying value has gone from £21 million to £32 million. Which in rand terms means that the valuation's gone from just under 500 to 723. So that concludes the presentation for today. Sorry we've run over a bit, but there was lots of information to give. We're very happy to go to the line for questions. I see we've got a couple of questions also on the email. So should we go to the lines first?
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now be conducting the question and answer session. If you'd like to pose a verbal question, please dial in on the audio line and key in star and then 1 on your telephone keypad. For the benefit of the participants who have connected via the webcast, you are welcome to pose your written questions in the question box provided on your screen. At this stage, we have no questions from the telephone lines. I will hand over for questions from the webcast.
Thanks. Look, the first one is probably for Dean and Mark to answer, and from Charles Bowles at Titanium Capital. The VA slides indicate that membership is not growing. The growth in profitability is accordingly coming from increased yields, which is presumably not sustainable in the long term. The increase in the attrition rate, 41 to 45, suggests that you are reaching the limits of pushing yield. Dean or Mark, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, Pete, happy to answer that. Look, I think it's been a yield strategy since, particularly through the course of 2025. I mean, there was a period from the post-COVID that we needed to regain our yield positioning. It's not a long-term strategy to keep pushing yields. You know, we increased the average, for example, in South Africa, we increased the average price by 12% in 25 is down to 6% in 26. So we're expecting a normalization of attrition rates in 26. And as I mentioned, that 47% for Q1 26 has already come on a May year-to-date number down to 45, so in line with Q1 2025. So it's not our strategy to keep pushing yields. I think we are comfortable that we've reached the right balance between getting the right quality of sales, getting the right member base that gives us long-term customer lifetime value, and yield increases going forward. Be very much focused on where we invest in capital, and we've seen that certainly in the SASA, for example, where we've invested in the clubs. Membership's been stable to growing, and where we haven't, that's where we've found more challenging market. And I think case in point, where we've invested significantly and we still got the same amount of members that we had prior to investment, but we've basically doubled the yield. So I think it's a valid point that we've deliberately pushed yields, but that's not a long-term strategy. We think we've got the right balance now between volume and yield to go forward.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. I mean, Charles, I'll just add to that to say, you know, there are gyms that you've got to take account of the fact that many of those gyms, take the point, for example, was closed for 6 months. So you're going to always have significant attrition, particularly there where you were increasing the price point very significantly. So, and I think where you've got a club that is full, you know, near capacity, if you invest in that club, you would rather have fewer members paying a higher yield than you would having more members. So I think, as Mark said, it is a balance, but I think it's been a purposeful balance that the team has driven. The next question, also from Charles. Please, can you clarify how the exchangeable bond convert price will be amended? The 199 is provisional, it seems. Is this dependent on the VWAP of the Brait shares post-rights issue? The answer is yes to that. The terms and conditions mean that you actually have to go and check what the VWAP was post the ex-rights price. So at the moment, that's a provisional number. Last time, it didn't change materially, to be honest, Charles, but we will need to get it run through the auditors and inverted commas once we know what that price is. So it's provisional, but I would be surprised if it changes materially. Last question from Charles. The listing time for VA Brait will have residual debt from the RCF, net of new look proceeds. The net deficit of the exchangeable bond, interest less Premier divs and costs, it would seem that this will need to be met by selling more Premier shares. Given that the Premier shareholding is at 19%, this suggests that Brait will not be able to unbundle shares cost effectively as they will not hold 20%. Is this understanding correct? No, Charles, that's not correct, to be honest. Yes, we will. We own 19%. There may well be. Let's just work on the numbers we've got today. 1.3 billion. Let's say we did get 700 odd from from New Look. That would leave a residual amount of 600 million that could either be serviced by proceeds, secondary proceeds from a sale, you know, in the VA IPO. That's the first option. Or obviously through some placing of the Premier shares at that point in time. The unbundling is not required. We don't need to own 20% to be able to unbundle the shares tax efficiently. So we would unbundle it to shareholders, and that wouldn't come with any cost attached to it. So the next question is from Mr. Patel. How should we think about the global wellness trend as it relates to GLP-1s and how Virgin Active fits into this? Are there any data points in developed market VA exposure where GLP-1s have a higher penetration relative to SA where it is still nascent? What are the plans to benefit from this from a VA perspective? Again, Mark or Dean?
Thanks, Peter. The GLP-1s in general across the sector, and that's both in nutrition and exercise, have played a role to actually increase the market. And we've seen a halo effect as people are using GLP-1s, are wanting to exercise more, wanting to eat healthier. So we see the GLP-1s as a positive trend in the market, in all the markets that we operate in. We have a partnership with one of the largest pharmaceutical companies, that's Novo Nordisk, who are the manufacturers of Wegovy. So we've trialed a partnership in South Africa with them that has been successful in a pilot number of clubs in South Africa. We're busy rolling that out to nationally in South Africa. We've commenced the project in Italy as well with Novo and Wegovy. And what we see GLP-1s as a much broader strategy in terms of weight management and not just weight loss. We see that people on GLP-1s, they do lose muscle mass, and an important part of the program is to maintain that muscle mass, and that's the role that Virgin Active can play, is how do we ensure that people on GLP-1s have a much more holistic view of weight management, and also provide off-ramps. GLP-1s in the long term are expensive. If people want to maintain their weight loss, we provide an off-ramp, which gives them the ability to exercise, to eat healthy. So overall, the data points that we've seen, even in South Africa, are strong, where we have a weight management program that includes the use of a GLP-1 product. And we're well positioned in terms of our partnership with Novo Nordisk to take advantage of the trend in GLP-1.
Thanks, Dean. Then the last question that I have from Errol Shear, can you confirm the change in terms for the exchangeable bonds other than the conversion price? Is it only an increase in maturity or will the coupon change? So Errol, there's no change in any of the terms of the exchangeable bond. The only thing that will change will be the exchange price will move from R2.21 to R1.99 provisionally around that level. It still remains maturity of December 2027, I think 4th of December 2027. The coupon remains the same. So the only thing that changes is the strike price effectively on the exchange. That is the only questions I have. So thank you very much for the participation from everybody. Again, thanks very much to Dean, Mark, and Curvis for all their efforts. And please feel free to get hold of us if there are any questions. We can answer those after the call as well. Many thanks.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's event. Thank you for joining us. And you may now disconnect your lines.